Hey, what's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is Monday, January 22nd. How are you guys? Did you have a great weekend? What's going on? Glad you're here today. I got a fantastic guest, a guitar god. This guy right here, let me give you a little backstory on this guy, my guest today. I think it was around 96 or something. A record called Car Wheels and the Gravel Road came out by Lucinda Williams. And if you've tuned into the show over the years, you've heard me shout out this record over and over. And that tour, I went to go see at the Fillmore Auditorium. I saw that tour a few times, but the first time was at the Fillmore. And I was in like the fifth row, and she was out there rocking it, just kicking ass. And I noticed to the right, I was like, who is this guy killing it on the guitar over here? The guy was dressed really cool, looked like Buddy Holly, was playing a wacky Music Man guitar. And they went into this track, Joy, which is a great song on the record. And he just completely melted the house down with his solo and his feel and his tone. And I was like, this guy is one of the best guitar players I've ever seen. Who the fuck is it? That man's name is Kenny Vaughn, and he is my guest today. And it was a damn honor to have this guy on. I didn't think I would ever get him on, and I want to give a shout out to my boy Steve Gorman from the Black Crows, who slipped me his email. And I shot an email to Kenny, and over a period of a few months, it happened. He happened to be in town on tour with the country legend, Marty Stewart. If you don't know Marty Stewart, you got to wake up, man. He's got a brand new record out right now that just completely hurts me, called Way Out West. And this record just kills. Check out the song Time Don't Wait. It is exactly the words I live my life by. And this whole record is crushing. It came out March 10th, 2017, and it is just fire. Mike Campbell from the great Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers produced it and recorded it at his studio, and it is a masterpiece. This record, I have been listening to it nonstop over the last month. Anyway, Kenny Vaughn is definitely in my top five guitar players of all time. And you guys are like, what? I've never even heard of him. Anyone can go out there and shred and learn the licks and not anyone, but you know what I mean. If you go out and you study and you practice, you could probably get pretty damn good, but do you have your own voicing? Do you have your own tone? Do you have your own style, your flavor? Are people going to remember you when they leave the gig? And that's with anything, comedy, acting. You know, you see a great movie, a guy has like one or two scenes, but he completely steals the movie. That's what I'm talking about. You know, over the years, the guys, yeah, the Randy Rhodes, the Eddie Van Halens, the Jimmy Pages. But there's a whole army of dudes out there in Nashville and stuff that play guitar that'll just make your head fucking fall off. You're like, what are these guys even doing? If you get into all these guys, and I talk about some of them today on the show, Jim Campolongo, guys that have this tone or style, those dudes that do like that pedal steel style playing. Even Jay Bennett, we talk about Jay Bennett from the early Wilco days. Anyway, Kenny Vaughn is a fucking American treasure. The guy is gold, and his stories were just fantastic. So what an honor to have this man on. And if you really want to see him play, check out the Lucinda Williams DVD live at Austin City Limits, or punch in Kenny Vaughn on YouTube. I recommend you watch this version of Ghost Riders in the Sky at Willie's Locally Known. It'll fucking knock you out. Anyway, Kenny, thank you for doing the show, and thank all of you for tuning in. Had a great weekend. I recorded the record at La Jolla Comedy Store. And I cannot thank enough the staff and everyone that came out to the shows. It was a magic weekend, and I definitely have this record in the can now. I feel that at this point, this is, I busted my ass, and I feel that this is going to be a very cool vinyl release on Bongload, a comedy record. And I want to thank my boy Manny, who recorded it. I want to thank Chase Bernstein and Lucas Hurl for opening the show, and Ryan and Mike Van and the entire staff at the La Jolla Comedy Store. And most of all of you that came out. One cool guy came all the way from Vegas. That was fucking so great. I always get like kind of choked up when I meet somebody and they've come a long way the podcast or the comedy means a lot to him. It's just so makes it all worth it. Some upcoming gigs. Buffalo, I'm coming your way. Buffalo Helium, I'm doing it with Steve Renazzisi, March 8, 9, and 10. So my New York trip will be postponed until March because I don't want to go to New York twice in 1 month. So if you're going to go see me at the Stand, it'll be now all most of March. Buffalo Helium, March 8, 9, and 10. This just in, Irvine next week, 4 shows. I will be featuring for the great Bill Burr. You better get your tickets right now if it's not sold out already. That is January 30th and 31st next week, 4 shows. Wow, that is going to be fucking fire. I guess that's really about it almost. The episode is brought to you by my great sponsor, TLG Auto. You got a Porsche and you want to get it serviced, or you're thinking about buying a Porsche and you live in the LA area, don't go anywhere else but TLG Auto. They've been doing it since 1978. You know Marco, I had him on here, remember? If you listen to this show, you know he was a fantastic guest and just had amazing Porsche knowledge. His father started the business, and now Marco's been over there just kicking ass. Follow him on Instagram, too, and just look at all the cool shit he's doing at his shop. It is in Los Angeles, in NoHo, North Hollywood, 13222 Raymer Street. Tell him I sent you. Don't buy a car without getting it inspected, man. That's stupid. You know, even though most Porsches are pretty easy to fix and stuff, go get that shit looked at. Give them a call. Tell them I sent you. Marco at TLG Auto. Also, the incredible Carson Hess Guitars. Yes, handmade guitars right out of Michigan. Follow him on Instagram, CarsonHess81, and hit him up if you want to get a custom style Telecaster or Stratocaster. And now he's even doing bass guitars, some P basses and jazz and stuff. And my Esquire is just absolutely breathtaking. Plays amazing. I love it. This guy is an artist and a king with the custom guitars. Check him out, Carson Hess. All right, guys. So anyway, thank you for supporting the podcast. I want to give a shout out. I finally made it to the 1,000 reviews. And let's see here. Who got that 1,000 review? I looked it up and it was like, boom, we were there. I got his name right here. Hold on. I wanted to get that. Where the hell is it? Here it is. The Heel, Rob Bronson, The Heel. He had the 1,000th. Review on iTunes. Thank you so much. That's rad. Keep leaving those reviews, people, and subscribing to the podcast on iTunes and my brand new Yahoo channel on Yahoo channel. Hey, my brand new Yahoo channel. Who the fuck's got a Yahoo channel? My brand new YouTube channel. Big love to some donations this week on patreon.com/DeanDelRay, Timothy Mitchell, loving you, dude. Loving you. Keeping the candles lit. Keeping the machines moving. Michael Fernandez keeping the candles lit on patreon.com/DeanDelRay. And Timothy Harrigan, I hope that's right. Timothy Harrigan, also fantastic donation. And Jeremy Seifert. Fuck yeah, man. All you guys. I love all you guys. And if I come to your town, you email me. I'm putting you on the guest list, man. There's nothing cooler than supporting this podcast. You email me. If you donated to this podcast, I'm putting you on the guest list. Unless it's sold out, then we're kind of fucked. But you know what I mean. Anyway, thank you so much for keeping the ship floating. I love you guys, man. And make sure you check out that Marty Stewart record. Here we go. Let's get into a little guitar talk with Kenny Vaughn. Yeah. That's awesome, man. That's awesome.
So tell me what is this podcast all about, man?
It's how are you, first of all? Kenny Vaughn, my guest today.
I'm doing good, man. I'm in Studio City. Yeah. At the Sportsman's, just had a nice smoothie, you know. Gonna go over to Iroha and have some sushi later on today. I've got it made, man. Sit by the pool.
You're going full LA.
Oh, yeah. Got the day off.
So. The weather, you look fantastic. Oh, you got long hair now.
Yeah, you know, I travel a lot, and, you know, sometimes we go to foreign countries, and my hair was getting kind of long, and I missed a haircut, and then I came back, and I missed another one because I got work at the last minute, you know, and I had to call my guy, man, I can't come in for the haircut, and he said, okay, man, we'll get you in, and then it never happened, so my hair kept getting longer and longer. Then I found I was over in England, you know, and, you know, I always felt that country music and politics don't mix, you know, so I never really say much, but people take one look at me and they can tell what side of the line I'm on, man.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, for the time being, I think I'll just let it keep growing just to, you know, kind of like that way I don't have to get involved.
It looks great. I really love the old school, of course, outlaw country, and, you know, where they just looked like, you know, dirty bikers, you know, out there on the highway playing rock and roll. You know, it was tough to decipher, to tell the difference between a biker and a country star.
Right, exactly. You know, man, I grew up in Colorado, you know, so I, you know, back in the, like when I was 15, 16, 17, 18, I used to follow the Grateful Dead around Boulder and Denver back in the 60s. Like, you know, and watch Jerry Garcia play all the time. And
God, he's one of my favorites ever.
He was the best back then, man. In 68, 69, he was like lightning on that thing, man.
That's
unreal.
Amazing you love them.
He was just unreal.
I mean, on the Strat, when he was playing the Strat?
I saw him play the Gold Top, and then I saw him play the SG quite a bit, and then I saw him play the Strat once.
Where were you seeing him at? Like the Boulder Theater and stuff?
No, the Boulder Theater wasn't. It was still a theater back in those days. Movies. No, I would see him at the UMC Ballroom on the campus. I never saw a show that had more than 250, 300 people at it.
Wow.
This is when they were
early
still,
on.
You know, Pigpen and the boys, you know. And,
the blues era.
Yeah, well, you know, they were doing their long jams, you know, the Dark Star and
the other one,
China Cat and that kind of stuff. So, you know, but they were unique, you know. And funny story, one time I went to this one gig west of Colorado Springs at a rodeo barn, right? They were playing, and they came on at midnight, and you know. And but there was a Kool-Aid stand there, you know, for refreshments. And they had on the right-hand side, there was a a cup of Kool-Aid for 35 cents. And on the left-hand side, there was a cup of Kool-Aid the exact same size for $3.50. So we got there about 8 o'clock, you know, and we bought the $3.50 guy, you know. And Owsley was their salesman, you know, he was their guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know.
Took it a ride. Did you take a lot of acid back then?
I did.
Yeah.
But you know, I was getting it from Boulder, and my cousin had a really good connection, and we were getting that orange sunshine from California.
That clean stuff?
The good stuff.
Yeah.
Before it went bad. You know, like about 1970, 71, it kind of just, it became real generic and not as good. But
kind of got a little speedy.
Yeah, but in 68 and 69, it was wonderful. It was hard to beat.
And were you a deadhead, or were you just like into Jerry's plan?
Well, yeah, I was a deadhead, but deadheads really, that term I don't even think was invented at that time, I don't think, because there was never, you know, I think the most people I ever saw at a Grateful Dead show was maybe 300 or 400.
Right? Yeah, so it's just early on, you're catching fire early on. How'd you hear about them? Was it like, did you get the first record?
I had the first album.
Right.
Yeah, everybody had that album. You know, and then when the second one came out, I was like, whoa, what is this?
Yeah.
What happened? You know, a little band, little rock band to like the Grateful Dead. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, this is the real Grateful Dead. All right, I like this. It was cool, man. You know. And then I saw Jimi Hendrix 3 times.
You saw Hendrix?
3 times, yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So you're growing up in Denver, and are you playing guitar at a young age? What
well,
gets you going?
What got me going was the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and then the Rolling Stones and the Kinks and the Animals.
Right.
Those bands are the 4 bands that got me going, those 4. And I was like, I told my dad, my dad had a jazz record collection, and he was a jazz guy.
And what did he do? Was he an artist. He was an artist.
He didn't play at all.
So were they hippies living out in Denver?
No, my dad was not a hippie. He was like a cool jazz 50s artist, you know. He was very cool, you know, like he'd been in World War II, and he came back and went to college and after the war, and you know, became an artist. And he was always a jazz buff. When he was in the war, he was stationed in San Diego. He was deployed in the South Pacific, but he would hang out in San Diego and watch the big bands. You know, he got to see like Buddy Rich's big band and Woody Herman and all that stuff. But then he got into cool jazz, you know, in the 50s. And when I told him I wanted to play guitar, he wasn't too impressed with the Beatles.
Yeah.
My mom kind of liked the Rolling Stones.
Oh, yeah, because like, they were like dirty,
she was like,
dirty version.
Oh, I like them. They play blues. I like them, you know. She was into the blues stuff. She recognized that with them, you know. But my dad's like, hey, you want to play the rock and roll stuff? Hey, you know, I said, yeah. He said, well, I got a friend who plays guitar. You really need... Well, I'll take you down to watch him play. And it was Johnny Smith.
Whoa.
Right?
Wow.
He lived in Colorado Springs. He used to come up to Shaner's on every Saturday night in Denver and play. So my dad used to... Before I had a guitar, he would take me down to Shaner's and watch Johnny Smith play on Saturday nights. You know?
Wow. How old were you?
I was... Well, when I first met Johnny, I must have been about 11. But then the Beatles, you know... kind of turned me onto guitar in a different way. I was like, well, I want to do that. I like that stuff, you know. But I didn't have a guitar or anything. But I was watching Johnny, and my dad had like, you know, he listened to like Jimmy Smith with Kenny Burrell on guitar, and I was very familiar with that sound, you know.
Yeah.
And Tony Mottola and Johnny Smith, and my mom had some Chet Atkins records.
Oh, awesome.
So I knew who that was. And...
So there's great music in the
house.
Yeah,
I was really lucky, you know. So Johnny Smith had a music store in Colorado Springs, and my dad took me down there, and they were friends, so he was the only dealer in Colorado that sold both Fender and Gibson.
Wow.
Because he was Johnny Smith.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
they kind of let him have a pass on that, you know. And so I went down there and bought a Telecaster, you know. It was like...
What year was it?
It was 66, brand
66,
new.
That's the year I was born.
Yeah, that's the year I bought a guitar. So I was 12 years old.
Was it a maple cap or
Rosewood? Rosewood.
Did it have the transitional logo, the fat logo?
No, it still had the old...
oh, wow, the spaghetti.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like
It was the transitional spaghetti.
Yeah, the gold. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kind
of
like a little bit more...
Wasn't it? It's like bulkier.
Yeah, bulkier.
It's not the black label. Right. It's not the spaghetti logo. It's transitional.
Yeah, transition. Yeah, I guess that is transition.
That's a sick ride.
But it still had the small letters on Telecaster.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't have the big black letters. But
what color?
It was blonde.
You know,
the cheapest one they
just
had.
Just the cream.
Yeah, it was like $176 or something like that.
Wow.
New.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my dad helped me, and we bought the case too. So
he's, yeah,
got to have a case to protect that thing, you know.
You still got that guitar?
No, man, it got stolen, as a matter of fact, unfortunately. But you know, I've had a lot of guitars over the years. So
you get that guitar, and you get home, and it was a lot like when I got a guitar. I got home, I got an SG, you know, I saved up all this money.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had a shitty, like, Seville before that, but I get the SG, and I got an Ampeg amp, and I don't sound anything like Angus, you know? When you get home, are you trying to figure out, how are the Beatles getting that, like, dirty sound?
Well, the funny thing about it, the reason I got a Telecaster was my dad had a friend, and who was a guitar player in a local rock band. He was probably about 4 or 5 years older than me, but which was a big deal back when you're 12, you know.
Yeah.
He might as well have been 10 years older than me, you know. And he had a band, and I told him I wanted to get a guitar. I said, I want to get a Fender Jaguar, you know, because that's what I thought I should have, because the surf bands were playing that, you know. He said, no, you don't want to get that, man. And he said, you want to get a Telecaster? And I said, really? I said, why? He says, because that's going to sound more versatile, and you're going to be able to do more stuff on it, and you're going to be able to get more of the kind of tones you want. And then I had the Having a Rave Up with the Yardbirds album, and Jeff Beck's on the cover with an Esquire, just like your...
Yeah, yeah, that one with the black, weird sanded corner.
Right, and the black guard. And he pointed at that. He said, you're not going to be able to sound like that guy with a Jaguar.
Yeah, man, that's cool. He steered you right.
And I was like, oh, because I want to sound like that. But it's funny, I got home and I couldn't make it sound like Jeff Beck.
Not at all, right?
I had a little...
It's so weird when you're first starting, right? Because you plug in, it's like clink, clink, clink. And you're like, oh,
I had a little phonograph, a tube phonograph, mono player, and it had an input on it, so I could plug my guitar into it, you know.
Oh yeah.
And it was tube, so you could kind of get it to sort a little. So I had that going for me, you know. And then I started playing, and a bunch of guys on my block who were older than me had a little rock band, so I started playing with them. And
just out of the gate, I mean, are you taking lessons or anything?
Yeah, I was taking lessons. I started taking lessons from my dad's friend who had the rock band, and he showed me stuff, and I started really getting into it. And yeah, I took to it pretty quickly, and I became the lead guitar player in the neighborhood band. And that band actually became pretty proficient quickly, and we started playing dances and making money, you know, and playing around at the CYO dances on Saturday nights.
Yeah, yeah, man. That's the shit when you're young, right?
Oh, man.
You're like, man, I've made it.
And there was girls standing around watching you play. You know, it's like, hey.
And people were way into live music back then.
Totally.
They got a band.
Yeah,
you remember that one? You go, hey, what's going on? There's two parties. One's got a band.
By 1966, you know, we had that first wave of sort of garage punk rock, you know, like, you know, every band played Gloria by them, and every band played... you know, Dirty Water by the Standells, and we played, Hey Little Girl by the Syndicate of Sound,
you know,
all that kind of stuff, you know, Psychotic Reaction.
Oh, yeah, great
by the Count Five, you know, and I got a fuzz tone, you know, so I could get that
little stomp box action,
yeah,
fuzz,
you know,
tone.
Got that tone, you know, that everybody wanted to hear. So we were really into it.
You remember what amp you were using?
I had my dad actually went to the Heath Kit Company and bought a little kit amp, and it was a 212 with reverb and tremolo, and he built it on the ping pong table downstairs.
Whoa.
It took him a couple of weeks, but he built it, you know.
He built your amp.
Yeah, it was really cool.
You had a cool dad.
Yeah,
man.
He was cool. But, you know, at first it wasn't that great of an amp for me. I mean, it sounded great with the reverb and the tremolo. I liked that a lot. You know, I was able to experiment with that a lot and get those kind of, you know, Rolling Stones, Slim Harpo tones that they had on their early records.
Like those old silver tones, that kind of vibe?
Yeah, but it was a solid state amp, so it didn't really break up too well. But when I got the fuzz tone, then I was set.
Right.
You know? And then I, you know, my the other guitar player in the band bought an old beat-up 59 Twin.
Whoa.
Tweed Twin.
Super
with 212s,
loud.
You know,
and awesome.
And when we started playing through that thing, it was like, whoa.
That's the best amp ever made, you think?
I think so.
I do too.
And his was just unbelievable. And then I got a Les Paul Gold Top and started playing through Fender amps, you know, like we'd buy old junk Fender amps. And, you know, back in those days, it, like, everybody wanted the new ones.
Yeah.
You know, and then I found the old ones really sounded good. So, you know, I was like, yeah. You know, but it was always the big problem in those days was to find somebody who would work on them and not alter them, you know.
Right,
people
right.
didn't really know that much like they now do now. You know, now you go to your favorite amp guru.
Yeah, you know, you they know everything.
You got your own guy that gets it just the way you want it, you know. And man, back in those days, it wasn't like that at all, man. It was rough, you know. But, you know, sometimes you get an amp and it would sound really good for a while, then it would break down and you'd have to buy another one, you know.
Yeah. So you're now, at the same time, you're going out and you're seeing live shows. You saw Hendrix.
Man, I was so lucky, you know. I saw so many great rock and roll bands at that time. I saw, you know, Hendrix 3 times. I saw the Grateful Dead countless times. I saw the Doors on their first
Whoa,
real...
Whoa, you saw the Doors?
Right when they released their second album.
Oh.
They came through Denver and I saw that show.
Wow.
And they came through several times, but I saw right when they first released their second
what
album.
What was that like?
They were really good. They were like a little, you know, like a collegiate bossa nova rock band, you know. They weren't terribly loud. The drummer was more of a jazz drummer,
yeah.
you know, and the guitar player was real cool, you know.
Yeah.
He was still playing his SG Special with the P90s.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
The 2 P90 ones.
He sounded great, man, and they were really good. And Jim Morrison, I actually, my best friend's older sister used to get us into these shows at this place called the Family Dog. It was an all-ages place.
Family Dog?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
They
yeah.
had one out in Denver for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
So she was hooked in there because her boyfriend ran the light show. And so we'd go in the back room, but I got Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek 2 Cokes.
Wow.
And they had their girlfriends with them, and they poured a little whiskey in the Cokes. And
you actually talked to Jim?
Barely.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but they didn't have much to say, and I was really shy. I was like, you know, I was really young, you know.
Yeah,
like 14 or something. You know, I look like Ernie on My Three Sons. You know, I didn't say shit to him. You know, I just gave him the Cokes.
Yeah.
Like, here
yeah,
you
I didn't be looking at him.
Yeah,
like,
they dispatched me down to the soda fountain to get a couple of Cokes. You know, and I came back and they poured some whiskey in there and they shared it with their girlfriends. They had their girlfriends with them and they were like a couple of college guys. You know,
yeah,
kind of well dressed. You know, kind of clean cut in their own way. You know, they weren't really. You know, they look like they just got out of the shower, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, they did have that look early on. I mean, they're out of UCLA.
Yeah, they were well-dressed.
You know, Manzarek and Jim.
Very UCLA kind of looking dudes, you know.
Collegiate rockers.
But then when they got on stage, you know, Morrison did his thing. You know, he had his black suit with his white frilly shirt, you know, black leather suit. You know, and he was really a good performer, you know.
Yeah.
But then I saw Howlin' Wolf there.
Wow.
At that place. So that was really amazing to see Howlin' Wolf and Hubert Sumlin on guitar. You know, it was like, whoa, what's this shit, you know?
Yeah.
I saw Cream.
Cream?
Yeah, they came through twice. I saw them twice.
Wow.
I got Eric Clapton a Coke.
Wow.
When during Ginger Baker's drum solo.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
And early on,
yeah,
now when you're going, because you you always dress really cool. I noticed that about you. But early on, are you noticing like, well, these guys got cool outfits and
shit?
Oh yeah,
like, man.
And are you out trying to find that stuff?
Well, you go see Jimi Hendrix. You know, he always dressed great.
Yeah.
You know? And there was a lot of people that you would see that would, you know. Plus, I saw some of the R&B acts like, you know, like B.B. King.
Yeah.
You know, people like that, they always, you know, the band's always wearing suits and they're always like, you know, super into their presentation, you know.
Yeah,
like,
even then, Jimmy Page later on.
Oh,
you know,
I saw the first Led Zeppelin show in the United States.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, they were bottom of the bill. Their name wasn't even on the ticket. It was at the Auditorium Arena in Denver, and it was their first show opening for Spirit, and Vanilla Fudge was the headliner.
Wow. That's when Spirit says they stole the song from Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah, they probably did, because they were on that whole tour, you know.
Yeah,
but anyway,
yeah.
They were opening, you know, Spirit was going on after Led Zeppelin. I kind of felt sorry for them, because Led Zeppelin just was like, once they were done, it was like the rest of the night was kind of a letdown. You
oh,
know?
God,
like,
right? They're playing like Killing Floor
on,
and
know,
all that shit,
like,
man.
I mean, they had so much charisma. You know.
And he's playing the telly then.
Yeah, he still had the telly. With the decals and stuff on it, you know,
yeah.
and the paint. And he had a Marshall head, and then he had some of those Rickenbacker Transonics cabinets.
Yeah.
You know, remember those things?
Were, yeah, yeah.
Those were their speaker cabinets, and the bass player was playing through the Rickenbacker heads, I think. Seems like I remember that, but he had one Marshall head on the floor. I remember seeing that, and it's like, okay, he's got a Marshall. Yeah, that's why he's getting his good tone, you know.
That shit was like, that early Zeppelin was like a punch in the face.
They were
dude.
So good, you know. The drummer was so nice. He had such a good tone, you know. He didn't pummel the drums like modern rock drummers do. You know, he was like a jazz player, you know. He just knew how to draw a big sound out of him, but he had a lot of finesse when he played the cymbals, you know, like, and his snare work was much more, he had more finesse than people give him credit for.
Right,
you know?
Right.
He was like, really had a nice touch. I saw him again when they did Led Zeppelin 3, and it was the same thing, you know. It was like, this time they were headlining a big arena, but they still had that, such an artful sort of way of playing between the three of them, you know.
Yeah.
This player sounded like James Jamerson, you know.
Zeppelin 3 is really...
great
the record for me, because you get into the acoustic stuff of going to California and Tangerine, that stuff. And at what point, because you obviously, I'm listening to you and you're a full-blown classic rock guy at that time, at what point do you realize, do you start getting into country? Is it like 70s outlaw stuff?
No, it was actually before that. My best friend that I went to school with lived across the street from me, and his dad was a motorhead who had a couple of garages and a couple of gas stations, and he built cars, and they had all these cool vintage cars and stuff, you know, scattered all over the place. One time he assembled a Harley in his den.
Yeah.
You know, like the big one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the big electric glide thing, you know. And he was a Johnny Cash fan and a Merle Haggard fan and a Buck Owens fan.
Right.
Those were his records. He had all those records.
Bakersfield
those
stuff.
Those three guys, you know.
Right.
And... you know, truth be told, I didn't really associate Johnny Cash or Merle Haggard or Buck Owens with country music.
Right.
Because, you know, like there was one station in town, KLAK, who played country music. That's where I first heard Ernest Tubb, who knocked me out. He just knocked me on my ass. I was like, what the hell is this? Who is this nut? You know, and I heard Ernest Tubb was like, this is great. You know, and my mom was like, what do you like that? You know, I was like, well, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, why, you know, who wouldn't like Ernest Tubb? You know,
yeah.
I wasn't ready for Ernest Tubb, and I really got into it. But I noticed that, you know, Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash didn't sound anything like the country music on the radio.
Yeah.
It really didn't. It, you know, the country music on the radio came from Nashville, and it was... you know, it was fine and dandy, but it didn't do anything for me.
Right.
You know, I was a rock and roll
kid. It didn't have that outlawness.
Well, Johnny Cash to me wasn't really a country artist.
Right.
You know? I guess he was.
What do you think? Rock and roll?
He was
kind of a spinoff of Elvis?
Well, he was on the same label as Elvis. He had the same producer as Elvis.
Right.
He recorded in the same studio at Elvis at the same time. And I didn't think of Jerry Lee Lewis as a country artist either. You know,
yeah,
I thought
no,
of Jerry
not at
Lee
all.
Lewis as
I never
a,
think of him.
Even though Jerry Lee Lewis, in my opinion, is my favorite country singer of all time.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think he is my favorite. I think maybe George Jones and Merle Haggard.
George Jones, man.
Have him maybe a little bit better at singing country than he is. But Jerry's my favorite. He's my favorite country singer. You know, his interpretation of, you know, like when he started having those hits in the late 60s, lots of country number one singles, you know, like she even woke me up to say goodbye and what made Milwaukee famous and that kind of stuff. He sings his ass off, man. He's the best. He can sing a country ballad and make you cry.
I always loved Willie's voice because
me too.
There's something about it, you know.
Those Texas guys, they all sound different.
He just
sing.
Really had something that would just speak to me through.
Yeah,
the
plus
speakers.
He was a jazz singer too. You know,
he's definitely jazz.
You know, he was Miles Davis' favorite male singer.
Yeah, because he's like da 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 da.
Yeah,
da, 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 da.
He's like a horn.
He's
player.
Like a horn player.
Yeah, he's like, you know, Miles Davis would go on. If you ever read Miles Davis' biography, he goes on and on about Willie. That's his favorite male singer, and you know, he's a white guy from Texas. But you know, and as you know, Miles isn't very big on white guys.
Yeah.
Even though John McLaughlin played in his band a lot, you know, that was his favorite guitar player, you know, white guy from England. But you know, he was, you know. Always kind of hard on the white guys. But, I liked Willie, too. But, you know, what? Back to my friend, you know, he had those records. So I'd hang out there every afternoon after school and listen to those records. And so one of the first things I learned on my guitar was the intro to Folsom Prison Blues.
Right.
Not off the live record, but the earlier studio version, you know, the that didn't really blow up until about a year or two after I got my guitar.
Right.
So, you know, that on the Folsom Prison album, you know.
Like 68?
Yeah. So, you know, and then, but when that hit, you know, I was, my friend always used to come over to my house and make me play that.
It really is.
And, you know,
it's the country sound, though,
man. I
mean,
when I could play that, he just thought, he's, you know, I had a telly and I put it on the bridge pickup and play it. And he was just like, he couldn't believe that I could do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really easy to do, but it was like, yeah, man. You know, so I was into, you know, those guys, Luther Perkins and Johnny and the and that band, that weird-ass band of his, the most strange band ever.
I like that era where he's playing with Dylan, you know?
Yeah.
Johnny and Dylan.
Nice stuff.
That's some great shit.
Yeah. You know, they could relate to each other, you know?
Yeah,
their
absolutely.
Music fit with each other, and they, you know... And then, you know, I saw Buck Owens and the Buckaroos in 68.
Wow, that's...
Back to appearance.
Yeah.
And, you know, they came out on stage and you were...
The nudie suits?
Yeah, you know, well, I don't think those were nudie suits.
No.
Those were made by somebody else. But anyway, Buck wasn't going to spend that much money on a suit.
Yeah. was he cheap?
But when those guys hit the stage, they were playing through dual showmans with coil cords, you know, and their matching suits, and they're just like sparkle tellies, you know. The
Burrito Brothers took all that, huh?
But man, when I saw them in 68, it was like, whoa. It's like seeing the Beatles. They were just like, it was like the best show you've ever seen in your life. I mean, Buck and Don singing, you know, harmony on the same mic, like just perfect singers. You know?
Yeah.
Both of them were great singers, man. And, you know, their show was real kind of corny, but high energy. You know, it was like a rock band, man. They just like mowed you over with their.
It was almost like the opposite. I mean, the not different music, but the kind of vibe of James Brown, what he was doing.
Very similar in some ways.
Exactly,
you know?
Putting on like the greatest show on earth. You know,
right?
Taking that shit around, knocking people out.
You know, Porter Wagoner in the 70s had James Brown on the Opry. I don't know if you know that.
No.
Yeah, James Brown played the Grand Ole Opry in the 70s, and it was Porter's idea. I got this guy. He's really good, man. He just knocked me out. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, you know, Mr. James Brown and the Fabulous Flames, you know.
Wow. Yeah. I love that shit. There was a period,
you know,
where I was only listening to James Brown, the JB era, you know.
Well, you know, he was always there on the AM radio. You know, you tune in your rock and roll station, but they, you know, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag was a big hit.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a huge hit. Cold Sweat was a huge hit.
Yeah.
You know, those were big hits, and you couldn't get away from them, and everybody was influenced by that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that late 60s band with Bootsy and his brother on guitar.
Or Sex Machine.
That shit, you know, like the Live in Paris record. That record... you know, and there's even like 70, 71 where James starts playing B3.
Yeah.
You know, when you start seeing that band.
He actually played B3 before that, too. There's some early 60s instrumental records where he's playing B3. Really primitive, but really good.
Yeah.
He reminds me of that guy, Wild Bill Davis, the 40s B3 guy. James kind of had that rough sound that Wild Bill Davis had.
Yeah. The B3 knocks me out.
Not as refined as, you know, Jimmy Smith and Jack McDuff and those guys, you know. He was more, you know, James is more primitive.
I love that. I love that guy that plays with Jimmy Vaughn right now.
Oh, he's great, man.
Holy shit, dude. I just saw him a couple months ago.
Man, I was just watching Jimmy on YouTube. He plays an organ trio gig.
Yeah, that's it. I went and saw it.
And there's a clip on there, and he's got Gatemouth Brown's Esquire.
Oh,
from
fuck.
The, you know, from the early Blackguard Esquire.
Yeah, yeah.
Some collector owns it, and he brought it down for Jimmy to play, apparently. And there's a clip on YouTube, and you can... look on Jimmy's Facebook page, and it's him playing that Esquire, that organ trio. Man, it's the best tone you ever heard in your life.
I tell you, man.
Sounds like a saxophone, man.
Yeah.
It's smoky. It's awesome.
I think the Fender Blackguard Esquire is the greatest guitar ever made. I used to be from
You're the second person that said that this week
I really believe it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because it is a machine, man. Mm-hmm. It's like having a crescent wrench or something. You can use it on anything, you know.
It's such a great guitar, man.
And that way that it's wired straight to the jack, you know,
bypass the tone control.
Yeah, just to get that hot shit going, and you know, it's really all you need. I mean, I don't know when I.
Well, I could do a gig on it, you know. That's kind of like my holy grail. I got to get one of those things before I die, a real Blackguard. Because, I tell you what, I've owned so many guitars, but when it comes to tellies, the ones I really like the most are the Blackguards for tone.
There's something about the
flat pole piece pickups. Yeah. You know? That particular, like the 50, 51, 52, 53, guitars are just so fat.
There's something about them, man.
They got extra power and mid-range, and they just blast.
And the neck shape.
Oh.
And then, of course, the color.
Everything about them is perfect.
The way all of them are different colored, mm-hmm. from like cigarette smoke or booze or sweat or anything. The logo, the pickups, the Bakelite pick guard.
It's hard to top. It's really the best looking guitar and the best. It just sounds so good to me.
Yeah, it really is.
You can move it in a lot of directions too. You can nudge it, you know, with your tone control and your volume control. You know, I was really lucky in the 70s to run into Roy Buchanan a couple of times.
Wow.
And I got to hang out with him, and he used to come to Denver, and he would use a rental amplifier. It was a Vibrolux Reverb, like a 70s Silverface Vibrolux.
Love those.
Vibrolux, you know, and he would plug his telly straight in, and he used to turn everything on 10.
Everything?
Everything on 10. The bass, treble, volume, reverb, everything. And he used the little reverb tremolo switch. That was his effects unit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I asked him, I said, man.
He dimed the volume too?
No, I said, how do you get in that tone with the volume, everything all the way on 10 on that amp? He says, I only turn my guitar up to like 3 or 4. And I'm always working with my tone control. If you ever watch me play, I'm constantly fiddling with the volume and the tone control. And I said, well, why do you keep your guitar turned down so far? He says, well, that way I got somewhere to go if I need it, you know?
Wow.
But really, he says, I'm mostly playing around 4 or 5 on my volume. And he said, it gives a different sound that way. And he said, if you want more, then you got more. And, you know, like for some of those ballads that he would play where he's getting those long, sustained notes, he would strike the note and then bring up the volume with his little finger, you know. But I used to watch him, and his finger was always on the tone and volume control.
Yeah.
He was constantly, he couldn't play for, you know, 3 measures without messing with his tone control, you know, and his volume control. He was always doing that, you know. So I kind of got hip to that idea, and I still do that today. You know, I still don't turn my guitar all the way up on stage, you know, when I'm playing. But a lot of guys, they just, you could unhook their volume control and they'd never know it.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm the opposite. I'm really into like if, you know, like the early Fenders, the controls work properly. But then by the early 60s or maybe even late 50s, I'm not sure when it all kind of went south. You know, if you rolled your volume down, then you lost your high end.
Oh, yeah, it changed the pots.
It changed the, you know, the signal. And I figured out how to, you know, put in caps that would change that kind of thing. But the early ones, they didn't have that. They didn't have a problem with that. There's like, you know, I'm still trying to figure out what the difference is. A friend of mine sent me some pots that he said they measure higher than 250. And he said that'll help get your high end opened up.
Wow.
Make it more... put some air on your sound. I don't really know that much about all that stuff, but
you never nerded out on that stuff. You were just more the player.
I just never was a guy that wanted to mess with the soldering iron and all that stuff. You know,
right.
I wasn't really an electrician. But now I know what a treble bleed circuit is, and you know, and it seems like every guitar you have to slightly alter the values of the capacitors to do the treble bleed circuit if you're having problems with all that stuff. And it's a never-ending quest to get your tone controls and volume controls to behave properly, you know?
I got to tell you, first of all, I'm so amazed to have you on the show.
I'm glad to be here.
I mean, I've been obsessed with you since the first time I see you. I go to the Fillmore in San Francisco, and I'm going to see Lucinda Williams on the Car Wheels on the Gravel Road Tour.
I remember that day.
So I'm there.
Open for Tom Petty.
Yeah, yeah.
They opened with Running Down a Dream, and they Tom and Mike and Scott all had Firebirds.
Yep. Yeah.
For the opening song. And they all played that.
Firebirds.
With Firebirds.
They had themes throughout the night.
Oh,
remember?
Man,
here's our SGs. Here's our Esquires.
It was so good, though. I was like, man, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Three vintage original Firebirds all playing the same lick and E. And it's like, yes. It's
so great.
It was such a great tone, man.
But I see you, and I'm obsessed with the Car Wheels on the Gravel Road record. I think it's one of the greatest records ever to be made, and I talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
And so I go to the show, and you guys, I see you on the right side. You're playing like a weird Music Man fucking guitar.
I still have that guitar.
Yeah.
And Sterling Ball gave me that guitar. It's an Albert Lee model.
Albert Lee, there you go.
Yeah.
My boy in at the drive-in, Omar, loves the Albert Lee model, and he kind of did a spin-off, and he has his own model now.
Cool.
You might love it. But anyway, I see you. You kind of look like Buddy Holly at the time, of course. And I think the other cat was he from Dylan?
John Jackson.
Yeah. So you guys...
He's a Nashville guitar player, too.
Guy,
I knew him before he played with Bob Dylan, and he still lives in Nashville and playing.
But you guys get into Joy, and you did this guitar battle that you did for a few tours. And throughout that tour, actually.
Yeah, she liked to let us stretch out and play.
And I'm telling you, dude, I've seen thousands of shows. I've seen a shitload of guitar players. I've seen them all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get into, like, rock guys or whatever, you know, you're Eddie Van Halen's.
I saw Eddie Van Halen on the they had a record out called Women and Children First.
Oh, the best. I saw that tour.
Jeez.
Incredible,
dude. They were so good.
Incredible.
And really entertaining, but man, his guitar play was just off the hook.
It's way beyond.
It was the coolest thing I'd seen, man. It was just like, wow, this guy is like Charlie Parker of the guitar, man.
But
unreal.
But what my point is, I see you play, and I'd not seen a guy that good in years. And it really fucking knocked me out, because I'm a huge music guy. I played music all my life.
Thanks, man.
And I played with some of the greatest players ever. Mm-hmm. And I hung out with the greatest players. But it was mind-boggling to watch you play. And I was like, who the fuck is this guy? You know, who is he? And then I ran down the rabbit hole trying to find out. And it was early on. Now you just pop on computer. Computer was around then, too.
Yeah, but there wasn't any information on it.
No, not at all. And then you seemed to be gone, like you were out of the band. I don't know if you got fired or you left. I had heard, like,
I was there for 3 years.
Right.
And I think she was ready to clean house and start over.
Right.
She wanted to move to L.A. and get an L.A. band, which she did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was working too much in Nashville, and, you know, I didn't want to move to L.A.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and also, you know, by then, you know, the Car Wheels, and then the next record. Did you play on the next record?
I didn't play on any of those records.
You didn't play on Car Wheels?
No, that's the story about that record is that Gerf Morlicks, her original partner, her Keith Richards guy, you know, I mean, they were like Mick and Keith, you know?
Right.
He arranged all those records and produced them, basically, you know? I mean, it was those were his baby as far as the guitar licks and all that stuff. So he came up with that, you know, they recorded that whole thing in Nashville, and then something happened. She used to hang out with us a lot. I was playing with Greg Gehring, and she would come down to our shows every Friday and Saturday night and hang out with us. But she wouldn't have anybody else with her, just her. And I used to go out to parties, and, you know, I got to know her real well, you know, before I played with her. And apparently she and Gerf had a big falling out after they got done recording the record.
And then they retrack it, right?
Yeah, well, I think they wiped his stuff off there, and then I think maybe Buddy Miller and some other
was
people
Rick
came.
Rubin involved at all? I heard one for a little bit. Maybe he worked on the record.
It was Steve Earle and Ray Kennedy.
They produced it.
Yeah,
Steve Earle. Wow.
Yeah, those were the guys. And so I'm not really sure exactly how it all went down, but basically they just you know, Buddy and I don't know who else for sure replayed all the parts, you know, kind of.
Right.
And it was kind of not cool, I think, the falling out, you know, the way it all went down.
And, yeah, obviously, if you're erasing so much trash.
And then they asked me to go out and play, you know, and unfortunately for me, I couldn't do it. And I was like, oh, I can't do it. But I was thinking the whole time, man, I don't want to be the GURF, you know, where's GURF guy?
Right.
You know, because, you know, those people that were her fans at that time.
Small town, too.
It was, you know, well, you know, especially in Austin and L.A., you know, it was like, yep. You know, those, you know, he had fans, too. You know, I mean, when people went to see her, they were expecting to see him as well, you know. And, you know, those records that they made were really good. And he was, I always thought he was a big part of it, you know, and I didn't know him, but I felt like I did, you know, because of listening to him.
Right.
And I thought this, you know, so I was kind of glad that I couldn't do it. And then I think they started going out and playing a little bit and you know, when the album first came out, Frank Colari was the manager. He's a brilliant manager. And he made that record. He got it out. And he's the guy that made, you know, made her...
crossed it up, got it out there.
Yeah, he was really had a good plan, and he called me into his office several times. He said, look, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to build this thing. You know, it's going to take a while, but this is what I want to do, and I want you to come out and play, you know. And so finally, I you know, my commitments were up, and I was like, okay, I'll do it, you know.
Yeah, and that's right. You got to look at that era. That's right when the lightning in the bottle hits of alt country, because mm-hmm. you got Whiskey Town, you got Wilco, you got Sunvolt, you got the Jayhawks.
Frank was Whiskey Town's manager, and
there you go,
and Ryan Adams' manager.
Right, so you've
so
got
he
this.
Made that. He also took Ryan from, you know, being just a little kid to being Ryan Adams. That was his, you know.
Right.
I used to be in the office when I go in there. He's like a little puppy dog running around in there, man. He's funny.
But
cool,
that's
I
that
like
era,
him.
You know, all of a sudden everything's hitting huge.
Yeah.
Everybody can't get enough of that shit, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, so we, you know, we toured straight for 3 years. It was really fun.
I'm telling you, dude.
I had a great
it
time.
It was fucking fire. I saw the tour multiple times.
Cool.
You know, headlining.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you guys come back and you headline. And then I see you again, play some K-Fog show. And then, of course, the Austin City Limits DVD and all that, you know, that whole era to me was one of the greatest bands. I think he switched drummers somewhere midway through, though.
I can't remember for sure. I know Donald played for a minute.
Right. But that band was fire. But your playing was smoking. And then I never saw you again. And I would always talk about you, you know, like, well, this guy, man, Kenny Vaughn, where is that guy? And then I didn't know you played with Marty Stewart. And then I started digging deeper and
yeah.
deeper. And then you had the solo record out and stuff. And
yeah.
I was like, wow, this guy. And then I really get into the rabbit hole of YouTube videos, like, you
yeah.
know, Ghost Riders in the Sky,
oh,
when you're
yeah.
playing that
yeah.
shit,
yeah.
you know, that trio you got.
Yeah,
and I'm
right.
like, holy smokes, this guy is out there burning it up, you know? At what point do you leave Denver and get to Nashville and decide I'm going to try to go for it in the country world? Because
well,
that's such a grind out there.
Well, what was going on with me was I had a, in the 70s, I played in a, well, first of all, the best thing that ever happened to me was I walked into my music store when I was about 16 or 17, and there was a guy in the corner that looked to be about, you know, 3-4 years older than me, and he was playing guitar, and I went up to the manager and said, who the fuck is that guy, man?
Yeah.
Who is that dude?
He was burning it up.
And he said, oh, that's my new guitar instructor, Bill Frizzell. I said, sign me up.
Yeah.
So the great Bill Frizzell was, he went to East High in Denver, and he'd been back east studying with Jim Hall.
Wow.
And he came back to Denver, and he was going nowhere fast, and he was teaching guitar down at the local music store.
That's crazy.
So I started studying with him for just, it was about 2 or 3 months that I studied with him. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, and he didn't know what he wanted to do with his. And we were, and he really was a great teacher in that he showed me a lot about the fretboard and music theory and how to interpret a song and different ways to look at it, you know, and without really imposing any sort of style on, you know, stylistic limitations or directions on me. You know, he's just like, oh man, you just got to do your own thing, man. You know?
Yeah.
I said, well, what do you do when you're playing? He says, oh, I don't know, man. I just play, you know. He's really spaced out. He's a great guy, you know.
Yeah.
And one day he came in and said, man, this is going to be our last lesson, and I got to get out of here. And I said, where are you going, man? He said, I'm going to New York, I guess. I don't know where else to go. And he said, I don't really want to be like a regular, normal jazz guitar player, you know. And but obviously he didn't, and he, you know, the rest is history. You know, he went to New York and became Bill Frisell, you know.
Yeah.
On hundreds of records now, and that are all over the place stylistically, you know. But he hasn't changed at all. He's exactly like he was that day in 1974 or 5 or whenever that was that I met him, you know.
That's wild. How much were the lessons? Like 20 bucks, 10 bucks?
Oh, they couldn't have been more than 10 or 15 bucks.
Right.
You know? Yeah, I'm sure.
And did a lot of your playing today goes back to those lessons?
Even like today, yeah, because I, like when I'm working on it, like if I'm trying to work up a tune, you know, sometimes I go right back to his way of looking at things, you know, and how to, you know, make the least amount of notes do the most work. You
right.
know, and find out what the important notes are in a chord, and don't play the other ones, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
that's so great. You know, like minimalist playing. But yeah, you know, what are you saying?
But you know, you can get rid of certain notes and never miss them, but that accentuates the important notes. You know, the two or three that you really want to hear, those are the ones you're playing. You know, so. Even now when I'm, you know, working on something, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't have to play that. I can just do this, you know. And, you know, it was really valuable information. A lot of it didn't really sink in for years because, you know, it kind of took practical application for me to really discern exactly what he was trying to tell me.
Yeah.
You know, and now I understand. I still have the lesson book, you know, from, you know, the 70s. I still have it.
Just yeah, that, it's, you know, a lot like comedy when you're doing, when I've learned from people watching the greats,
right?
You know, you learn all these terms to where later on they sink in, you know, like
exactly.
What's your voice? Same right. with guitar playing,
right?
Who are you?
Yeah,
how come? Why am I still thinking about Kenny Vaughn over the thousands of dudes I've seen
right, yeah.
since or 96 or was, something?
I played with Lou in 97, 98, 99.
But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's a reason why I yeah. still there's guys out there that sit with you and just go like, I still think Jay Bennett from Wilco.
Oh, he was great.
He was great because he was doing that whole ta-gow, you know, that pedal steel kind of thing that pull away.
He did a lot of stuff, man.
He was so great at playing, you know, very underrated.
I used to play with this girl named Kim Ritchie.
Oh, Kim Ritchie, of course.
Great, wonderful yeah. person.
Chuck Prophet.
Yeah,
around.
She's so good. And we were tour in England, and we were opening for Wilco back when those guys had their initial success.
Yeah, like being their record.
Yeah, the early stuff. And this is in the 90s, probably about 90, before I played with Lucinda. And we were opening for those guys. And remember one day, I went to sound check, and the singer wasn't there. And it was John and Ken Coomer on drums, John on bass.
Oh, Ken was great.
And Jay, and they did Cortez the Killer.
Oh, killer.
And you know, they sort of launched into it at soundcheck, and John was singing it, you know, and he was singing it really well. And then they got to the solo section, and they jammed for like 15 minutes, you know, and Jay was just killing me, man. It was like Neil Young all over again, man. It was just like the coolest, most outrageous stuff that you ever heard in your life, man. It was like, I was like, man, these guys should do this.
Well, that's
what so good.
Those
man.
Are the dudes that you remember because you're yeah. like, you're going, oh, yeah. holy shit, you know? Like, yeah, I think that there was that really the problem with guitar. And if we get into it, you're going to go Hendrix, of course, if we're talking rock. And then you get to Eddie Van Halen, and then it's like Randy Rhoads or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then Stevie Ray gets hot and everybody gets a Strat and a hat,
yeah, right.
and they all want to be the same. And it was just
nobody
was,
ever sounded like Stevie Ray.
And, yeah, and Stevie Ray was
and nobody ever sounded like Eddie either.
Nope.
You know, all those guys started tapping and doing his thing and trying to figure out how to do that, but they didn't sound anything like him.
Yeah.
When I saw him live, it was like, this is amazing. Like, and I never heard anybody that sounded like that again. You know?
Never.
Not even remotely like that. It was like he has such a presence of personality and touch. You know, he had his own touch and his own sound and his own vocabulary. It was just so good, man. I couldn't believe it. It was amazing.
I mean, that's a big part of guitar, having
Jeff
your own
Beck's
vocabulary.
Another one of those guys.
Yeah, Jeff
you know,
Beck.
I remember I was in a studio in London one time. He was in the next studio over, and he was just had plugged into his amp, and he was just like tuning his guitar up and setting the controls on his amp, and it was like, even that.
Yeah.
I was like, nobody else sounds like that when they tune up. You know? You know? He was like playing just like simple chords and playing a few licks, and I was like, oh my God.
It doesn't
Beck.
Even matter what guitar he's playing.
It doesn't
matter. He played
matter
Les Paul
anything.
For a while. He played it Strat.
It never
he played
mattered
the telly.
Because it was all in his fingers. And when he just played like a few licks, and me and this other guitar player, this guy that works, plays guitar for Sting.
Oh, yeah.
Dominic, I think is his
right.
name.
Right.
He was there, and we were like, we're listening through the door and we're looking at each other and we're just like shaking our heads like, oh my God, listen to that. You know, like that's the real guy right there. There
yeah.
he is.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody sounds like that, you know.
Nobody does.
There's
sound
no way
like
you
that.
Could sound like that, man. I mean, don't even bother to try because he's got it.
So you take these lessons and it's time to boogie to Nashville?
Well, no. I didn't even ever think I was going to go to Nashville. What I did was... I played in this little jazz band that was really forward-thinking with these guys that were all, like, really good musicians. They were my age, but they were, like, Berkeley guys. And they were really good. And we were playing, like, that sort of pre-fusion, early 70s stuff. The music was all over that place in like, 1970 and 71.
Yeah.
Like, it was, like, the most wonderful time for, like, a lot of different kinds of music. Because, you know, you had prog rock. Was, you know, like King Crimson and bands like that were just like, you know, the Soft Machine, those kind of
Soft
bands,
Machine.
You know, just like the most awesome, outrageous stuff, you know? And then you had like all these different jazz people that were just starting to really open up and blow the doors open on stuff, you know, like Miles Davis was doing, you know, Bitches Brew and Live Evil and On the Corner and that stuff. And it was like, whoa, you know, John McLaughlin's playing guitar in his band and just like, you listen to John's solos on the Corner, the first solo, it's like looking at a cubist painting. You can't even tell what key he's in or what notes he's playing. It's just these shards of notes coming at you, and you're like, whoa, what is that? You know, I don't even know where to begin.
And it's so fresh and new.
And he's obviously having a ball doing it, but you can't tell what he's doing. You know, it's like, what is that? It's just, it's like, it's pure art coming at you, you know? And then like Weather Report's first album came
oh, yeah.
out, you know, and I was like, what's this, man? This is great, you know? And, you know, guys like Wayne Shorter and, you know, Joe Zahn all, you know, opening things up and, you know, sort of throwing the rule book out and doing their own thing, you know? So these guys I was playing with were doing that. You know, it was not really fusion, but it was what, you know, fusion kind of got corny and became very, you know, like Weather Channel music, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like Weather Channel jazz, you know, and it's not my thing, you know. So I didn't really last in that band very long. But meanwhile, I had a little rock and roll band that played parties.
Yeah.
And we played, we were a big Dr. Feelgood fans, the band from England, you know.
Right.
Wilco Johnson. And we were digging that whole sort of minimal kind of back to the basics, you know. Wilco played a Telecaster, very, you know, playing rhythm and lead at the same time.
Yeah,
really.
Were you writing your own songs?
We started writing our own songs after, you know, we kind of like about 6 months. We were having so much fun, and we started writing our own songs. We found out we could write songs, so we started writing loads of songs.
Yeah.
And then there was this like punk rock scene in Denver. These guys had a record store called Wax Trax, and we became their party band.
Wow.
And then there was all these punk people that were, and at that time, punk music hadn't really had an identity yet. It was like,
it's not that 70s punk yet.
It was like, you go to a show and there'd be three completely different kinds of bands, you know, playing three, you know, you had bands like Peru Ubu,
yeah,
you know, that played to the punk audience, but they weren't punks, but that was their audience. You know, we were kind of like a cowpunk band. You know, we were from Colorado, and we started. We became pretty popular in the Denver area and Boulder area, and then
what was it called?
The Johnny Three.
The Johnny Three.
Yeah, the Johnny Three, and we were just a silly little band, but we played our own tunes. We kind of became popular in Chicago because the Wax Trax guys moved to Chicago and brought us up there. We started playing around the Midwest. So I lived in Chicago for a while, and then we went to New York, and I lived in New York for a while.
Wow, where were you living?
Lower East Side.
Lower East Side, man. And like the, what is that, the 70s, yeah. So it's like a dollar to live there, right?
Oh, man, it was so nice. It was great, you know, and I saw so much good music. And
were you playing, like, Cafe Wall, shit like that?
No, I was playing, what was that place called? Quite a few places. The Danceteria and Maxwell's and Hoboken. And,
oh, yeah.
Spring Street something. Oh, I can't remember the name of that place.
Were you seeing other guy? Like, you seeing Springsteen around at the time or anything?
No, I didn't see him. I was hanging out in the New York scene. There was a band called the Ray Beats. There was a band called the Bush Tetras, who I really liked.
Yeah.
They were three girls and a guy. Their drummer was a dude, and then three girls. They were awesome. They were talk about super minimalist art people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's that kind of Warhol era, you know,
yeah, like post Warhol era. You know, it was like, you know, James Chance and the Contortions and James White and the Blacks. He was the same guy, you know, James. And Talking Heads, of course.
Awesome.
Had already sort of weren't really playing locally anymore. But I used to see them when they did at CBGB's when they were still a trio, you know. And I was a big Ramones fan, big Cramps fan, big, you know, we were, of course, you know, we followed all those kind of bands.
Yeah.
We're just into all that stuff, you know.
I mean, you got all the bullets in the chamber then. You got classic rock.
My favorite band at that time was a band called DNA. And then that guy also played, the guitar player was named Arto Lindsay. He also played in that band, The Lounge Lizards.
Oh, yeah.
And, who were, snarky sort of lounge, weird jazz kind of band, you know. They were great, man. So cool. So, you know, we didn't really, you know, our ears are wide open to everything, you know. And anyway, when I, during this whole time, my parents moved away when I was 18. They moved to Kansas, and I didn't want to go to Kansas. So I never wanted to get a job. So I found that just by accident one day that I could go down to the local honky-tonk and play 6 or 7 nights a week, never have to leave town, play with these old guys playing country music.
And in Nashville?
In Denver.
In Denver?
Yeah.
And wow, they had that going on?
While I still had my jazz band and my country band,
right.
I mean, my rock and roll band, I could go play with these old dudes who were really good playing in an old honky-tonk for old people, you know.
How'd you get hooked up on that? You just met a guy?
Totally by accident. And I knew some of the guys through the guitar scene, you know, some of the local guitar stars because of the music stores and stuff, you know.
Right.
And those guys were really good. I mean, there were some super good players in Denver, really advanced guitar players that could really play that were country guys. And so, you know, it was just like there was a black blues scene there too. There was a guy named Sammy Mayfield who was a great blues guitar player. You know, so, you know, if you're a guitar player, you go
exactly.
See the good guitar players. You don't care what kind of music they play.
Yeah,
you know?
Not
you
at all.
See them play, you know.
And you hear around town, they're like, yeah. Oh, you got to see this guy.
Yeah,
you go
so,
see
you know,
him.
I was always going to check out all the good players anyway. So I started playing with some of those guys. And they were cool because if I had a gig with my rock band, they'd let me call it a sub because it was just a honky-tonk, you know.
Yeah,
playing
totally.
Old country music from the 50s and 60s, you know. And a little bit of 70s, but mostly older stuff, you know. Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and Buck Owens and Wynn Stewart and Ray Price and Webb Pierce and that kind of stuff.
So know? That's your lead into your full country skills.
Yeah,
like,
well,
skills.
You know, and the whole thing about that was I have friends that were playing in cover bands playing rock music for money. You know, and but they were having to play this shit that I didn't want to play, like, you know, Journey and,
yeah.
You know, I was like, I don't want to play Journey.
Boston.
All that stuff, you know, I was like, God, I hate that stuff. Man. I couldn't ever fancy myself.
You didn't get into that early Journey?
No.
Oh man.
No, like, man. I was not into it.
You ever check that shit out where it's
I'm aware of that.
Greg Raleigh and it's just fusion.
Yeah, I know what it is, and I was aware of their, you know, expertise and everything, but I, you know, for whatever reason, you know, there's always music that you're not into, you know, and there's a whole lot that I wasn't into, and you know, I don't know, man. There was a lot of stuff that I just couldn't do, you know, and I didn't want to do. And
like that mid-70s stuff?
Well, a lot of stuff, man. You know, and most of the stuff my friends had to play was like, I go see my friends play, and they were making good money, you know, down at the rock club, you know, but they were, you know, like sort of pre-hair metal kind of stuff, you know, right. And I was like, oh, I don't know about this, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd already been tainted by, you know, Velvet Underground records and Ramones records.
You're not fucking,
you know,
around with that shit.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to fucking Dr. Feelgood, you know. And
what, like, are they playing? Like Nugent, Cat Scratch Fever? Is it pre that or what era?
Yeah, they played that, yeah.
Right, yeah.
A lot of stuff. I don't, you know, I'm trying to remember.
Eagles,
Eagles? They didn't play the Eagles. That was too country for them.
Oh, wow.
You know, they were playing more. I didn't like the Eagles either. I saw the Eagles on their first tour.
Yeah.
They were opening for somebody, and I remember standing there and I was like, I really like that guitar player. It's Bernie Ledden.
Bernie
Ledden was playing guitar. I was like, man, this guy is awesome. And then the bass player was from Denver, Randy Meisner. And I was like, man, he's great. I love his voice, you know. But the two singer guys, Don and Glenn,
yeah,
I didn't know who they were. But I remember I was standing there watching them. And I was a kid, you know. I'm like a teenager. And I'm like, these guys don't seem like cool people to me. You know?
You know? Like, there's something it's funny because...
It's like, you know, I saw Mick Jagger and I thought he was cool, you know.
Yeah.
And I saw, you know, all kinds of people. I was like, well, you know.
They were kind of nerds, you know.
Well, they were just like, there was something about them. They didn't seem like a lot of the other rock stars I'd seen. They were like, you know, I saw the Birds. They were cool.
Yeah.
You know, they played country rock and they were groovy, you know. And, you know, I saw all kinds of country rock outfits, but this one, I was like, I don't know, man. These two good. I got a bad feeling from those guys.
That's funny.
Turns
because,
out I was right. But I know all these people that have worked for him over the years. So
a lot of country people do not like the Eagles.
Well, I like their record called Tequila Sunrise. I think that's a great record. And I like, there's another one of theirs.
I like the Long Run record. The last one, man. It was so
there's
weird.
There's just certain songs I like, you know, but for the most part, I didn't care for most of it, you know.
Yeah. A lot of Graham Parsons people hate the Eagles, you know. It was like, there was that era where it was like
on the Graham Parsons.
Yeah, Burrito Brothers and
although, you know, those they weren't exactly noted for their expertise, you know, as far as their intonation and all that stuff. I still liked his songs, you know.
Yeah.
Even though he wasn't the greatest singer in the world, you know. He's all right, you know. I liked him.
Yeah. So you start playing in the honky tonk.
Yeah, so I'm doing that and I'm making, you know, I'm working like six nights a week.
Wow. And what kind of money are you making? Like 100 a night or something or 25?
Back in those
50?
Days, I was making like $300 a week, you know. Something like that, you know. And, but, you know, my overhead was nothing, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had plenty of money to spend and I was like, I felt like I had breathing room because I didn't have to travel, you know. I just go down the street and play in the honky tonk, you know, and everything was always the same. If I left for a couple of weeks to go do something else, I came back and I just
always had a paycheck.
Always had right back into my slot, you know. So when I was, I did that in the 70s and then I played with another guy that had a little bit more high profile thing. He was more of a country rocker and he played a regular gig in a club. And I could play his gig too, and that was really fun. His name is Gene Chalk, and he'd been in the Stone Canyon band, Ricky Nelson's band,
right?
And he'd been in. He'd come to California, made some records with his old rock and roll band from Denver, and then he went back to Denver. And he was a custom car painter, and he worked all the time. And he was really fun to work with. But anyway, you know, I was able to support myself by playing country music. And I learned how to play it from these guys that were really good. You know, they were like really good. And so I was, you know, I'm in my early 20s playing with guys that are in their mid 50s, you know.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But they were really good players, you know. And I learned a lot. You know, the steel players were really good. You know, guitar players were great, you know. And it was like, oh, yeah. And I met all the people in the country scene. And they kind
of. And you really learn how to play in a band that way of in and out of other guys, listening to what people are doing, not overplaying.
All that stuff, you know, and I had all that good experience and they accepted me for who I was. You know, I was, you know, the Kenny, the weird punk rocker, you know, that doesn't dress like us, you know.
Yeah.
But they always took me under their wing and, you know, treated me right. And, you know, I never had any bad problems. You know, it was like I was just one of the family, you know. I was like the weird little brother in their family, you know.
It's funny because you dress like them now, right?
Probably so, yeah.
Yeah.
I really do. Yeah. You know, they'd be proud of what I'm doing with Marty Stewart. You know, they're all dead now. But so anyway, you know, I traveled with my rock and roll band, lived in Chicago, lived in New York. I wound up back in Denver playing back on the honky-tonk scene. I had a little band that I played a few shows with, you know, out in the rock and roll scene, but I didn't really go very far with that. I wasn't really trying too hard. It was my old partner that I wrote songs with in the Johnny Three. And I don't know. There was a lot of drugs at that time, and everybody, all my pals were sort of going down.
Cocaine's hitting big then?
Yeah, and heroin.
Yeah.
They got into that. My old rock band guys.
Were you fucking around with that stuff at all?
Not habitually, you know,
right?
Not like every day,
right?
I tried everything, man.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
I rode all the rides.
Were you doing any dope?
Well, I played at a bar that was a money laundering operation for a Puerto Rican drug lord, and he would stuff my pockets full of free cocaine every week.
Wow.
So, you know, it was like, you know, it was a biker bar, but it was like he loved our band, and he was like, he was a kingpin, you know, and he was like, "You guys do a good job for me. I love you guys, you know."
He'd
overpay me.
Yeah.
And then I'd, you know, wake up, you know, we'd play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then I'd wake up like on Tuesday.
and your telly was gone. a blur.
Well, it would be like I wake up on Tuesday and I'd be like, wow, you know, I'd be looking for something. There'd be, you know, bags of cocaine, you know, and stuff on the table, you know. I'm like, whoa, you know, what am I doing? And a friend of mine called me from Nashville in 1987, and he was like, "Hey, man, I got this gig down here. We need a guitar player like right now."
Wow.
And it's like, we got this tour coming up. It's like 3 weeks, pays really good. If you come down and do it, you know, can you get here like ASAP? So I jumped in my car.
Yeah.
Went down there. The deal was they had just moved from LA, all these people. And my friend had been playing with Lowell George.
Oh, rad.
And Lowell died.
Little Feet, huh?
Yeah. Well, he was on that tour when Lowell George was doing the solo thing. Don Heffington was playing drums. And anyway, they... my friend was the piano player, and he'd been working with Vince Gill in LA, and Vince Gill had a wife who had his wife had a little duo with her sister called the Sweethearts of the Rodeo. And so this guy was playing piano for her because Vince wasn't doing anything. And, he was trying to get something going in Nashville, but he wasn't really happening. And, so he had to make some money. So this was the band. It was called the Sweethearts of the Rodeo, and they had a couple hits on the radio, and I'd heard them. You know, I was like, "Oh yeah, I like those songs, man. They're cool," you know, and they're, you know, Southern California country rockers, you know.
Yeah.
But they were pretty good, and so I went down there, got a tape to listen to on the drive down to Nashville.
Yeah, yeah.
I never thought I'd go to Nashville. It's like, oh yeah, I'll get to go to
Especially
Nashville.
Back then, it was kind of no man's land, right? It was like, you know, New York or L.A., really, you know?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I didn't know what to expect, and I got there, and everybody was really nice, and I started working, you know, with these guys, and I met everybody like the first week I was in town. Like the first 4 days I was in town, I met so many people. I couldn't believe it. You know, it's like, wow, this is great, you know. So I just stayed there, and I kept playing the gig. I played that gig for like 5 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, and it was really a good gig.
Did you ever go back and get your shit, or you didn't have anything?
Actually, my mom and dad went to my apartment and packed it up and brought it down for me.
Wow.
Because I couldn't really quite get out of it, you know. And like, I had some guy like subletting my place, and I was like, "Yeah, why don't you go get my stuff, man?" You know, and they brought it all down. I didn't have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
5 years in Nashville.
Right. And so, you know, 5 years of playing that gig. And then I got called for a audition with Patti Loveless, and I got that one, and I started recording with her and playing on the road with her. Did that for a couple of years. That's where I met my current wife, and that was we've been married for like almost 25 years now.
So, wow. Yeah. 25 years.
Three kids.
Now, she's a player, too?
Yeah, she was in the band playing fiddle and singing harmony and mandolin, and she's also a really good sax player, but she's a songwriter and good singer, and she's played with, like, James Taylor and...
Badass.
Olivia Newton-John, Patti Loveless. She's recorded with all kinds of people. She's, you know, really a good singer, really good harmony singer.
Let me ask you a little bit. Of course, Nashville has changed so much from the 80s to now. It's got to be pretty fucking cutthroat to be a hired gun in that town, right? There's like a certain amount of guys that get all the work for over
the
years.
I don't really know because, you know, now, I mean, let's face it, you know, the music scene that is associated with the country music business there now is... They call it new country, you know, and
right.
I don't know anything about that stuff, you know. I don't know any of the songs or what the artists, I don't know them, I don't know their music or anything about it, you know. I'm not in that line of work anymore, you know. The country music that I played there was sort of like 90s country, you know.
Right.
80s and 90s country, and then...
Tim McGraw era, that kind
of
shit.
I never even heard of him, you know.
Right.
I've heard of Tim McGraw, but I can't name one of his songs,
right.
You know. I basically quit listening to country radio in the late 80s, early 90s. The last guy that was a star that I can name his songs was Dwight Yoakam.
Oh, great, man. I love that song, I Blame the Vein. I opened for him on that tour.
See,
I Blame the Vein. What a great fucking record.
I love that guy.
And he had that guy on guitar that was a...
Pete.
Yeah, and then he was gone. Once he was gone, it kind of changed. But that was.
Yeah, they had a good combination there going for a long time, and I love that band, and I love the songs and the records, and I thought Dwight was really good, and that was the last country star that I ever paid any attention to. You know?
Well, I think that Nashville's always kind of had that weird thing. Like right now, you got some guys like...
He didn't record any of that stuff in Nashville. You know, that was all done in L.A.
Right. Oh, of course. Yeah. But I'm saying now. You know, you do have that belly of like, you know, Sturgill and Stapleton. And
I like Chris.
Yeah. And I love Jamie Johnson from years back. You know, he had that high cost of living record.
See, I didn't hear that. But then we did some dates with Jamie recently, and I kind of got hip to him on the back end.
Right.
You know, I didn't really know. I'd heard the name, but I'd never heard his stuff, you know, when he was having all his success, and I didn't. Then he started going out with a friend of mine, and you know, I was like, she was like, yeah, you know that guy, Jamie Johnson. I was like, I know the name.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know him, you know.
That high cost.
But then I finally did meet him, and he's a nice guy, and, you know.
But I mean, those guys skim around. Every few years, it seems a new guy comes up that's like bucking the system. You know, fuck all that shit.
I think he did pretty good bucking the system.
Oh, he did, man.
He was fairly successful from what I gather.
That record is phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm not hip to that record, unfortunately. I should go back and listen to it. I've never heard that stuff. But, you know, I've heard Chris Stapleton's stuff the most. I used to work with him in the studio years ago doing demos.
Yeah, he had that rock band.
Well, this is before that even. He was just in town writing for other people.
Right.
But I noticed how good he was. You know, I was like, this guy's amazing. He sits down with the acoustic guitar and makes a perfect recording without even having to overdub his vocal. You know, just playing his guitar and singing. It's like, man, this guy's a hoss.
Right.
And then he had that band, the Steel Drivers.
That rock band.
Which I thought...
They were kind of Black Crowes-y.
No, that was... The Steel Drivers was the bluegrass band.
Oh, who's the...
And they had one called the Johnson Brothers.
Yeah, that was it.
That was the more...
That shit was like Black Crowes.
Yeah, and that's the same bass player that he uses now, who used to be my bass player for a while. And when I was doing a little trio thing, the drummer and the bass player for Chris were my band. And so I'm hip to Chris. He's good, man.
Sturgill. I think I like Sturgill. I see Sturgill and I think, oh, wow. Like whenever I see these guys, I think, man, if Kenny Vaughn was in this band, it would be over the top. I always think that because
man,
you get
well,
this
he
great...
had the best guitar player for a while, man. That guy from Estonia.
Yeah, he just let him go, right? Like a year ago or whatever, and went down to like he plays the leads again or something. I don't know.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
I ran into Joe, the guy from Estonia. I ran into him it's been about a year, and he was like, yeah, man, he was going to Atlanta to play a gig or something. I don't know. He's playing down there with somebody. Maybe he's playing with, man, I can't remember who he's playing with. Somebody cool.
That's a weird gig though, right? Because look, you're playing with, like you were playing with Lucinda. Like, I don't know if you watched the Hired Gun documentary. That's mostly, you know,
no,
in the
I've
rock
heard
world.
About it, yeah.
But you know, when you're in these gigs, you're always constantly thinking, who am I going to play with next, right? As far as like, I mean, yeah. You've been playing with Marty Stewart forever, but I'm saying when he's not on the road, you're looking for work, right?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, when he called me, I was just doing session work in Nashville. I was, you know, I'd been off the road for over a year, and I was doing pretty well just playing recording sessions. I wasn't really enjoying it that much because the music wasn't very fulfilling, you know?
Right.
It was like, you know, I would have to, as soon as I got in the car to go home, I'd have to
watch
something I liked in the CD player and crank it up really
loud.
Yeah,
you played on a lot of crazy stuff. You played like Lana Del Rey.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I liked that record. That was great. I like her. She was cool. I didn't know what to think when the first, you know, hour after working with her, I was like, oh shit, this chick means business, you know? She was a serious artist that showed up early, was, you know, stayed late, was straight the whole time, all business, man. She's a hard worker. I was really impressed with her. She knew what she wanted to do, and we worked our butts off on that record, man. Long hours, and it paid off. It was really good.
You played on one of my favorite records of last year, hands down, Nikki Lane.
Oh man, that was fun.
I'll tell you what,
that song Jackpot is one of my best things I ever played.
That fucking song smokes, and when I found out you played on it, I was like,
I think there's eight guitars that I tracked on that song.
No shit. Yeah. Well, you know, somebody turned me on.
Normally I don't do that, but I was like, oh, I think I'm going to, you know, this is a tricky little number. And I got it together with the engineer real quick. And I said, give me 40 minutes. I'm going to, you know, I will be done with this. Just, you know, you guys go take a break. And because I got to do all these overdubs real quick.
Holy shit.
And it was simple, but it was, you know, I knew what I wanted to do and I knew how I had to do it. And the engineer was really quick. He knew exactly what to do. And we were done in like 30 minutes.
It took us, wow. You know, what a great record. Now, she reminds me a lot of, not the style of Lucinda Williams, but some great songwriting, super authentic. And then, of course, then there you are playing on this thing. And I'm like, God damn, this track, that record, actually, is, you know.
They did a good job on that record. She and her
really
boyfriend
good.
Produced that kind of themselves, I think, you know. And they did a good job, man. She's a hard-working person, man.
Yeah.
That chick never takes any time off. She has her own clothing store.
Oh, really? In Nashville?
Yeah. And, I mean, it's called High Class Hillbilly, I think. And I've never been to it, but I got to go over there. And, man, she's a powerhouse. Always writing tunes, always working on the road, working in her store. She, like, never takes a day off.
I'm dying to have her on the show.
Oh, man, she's fun.
That record knocked me out.
She will make you laugh.
That record knocked me out.
She is a character. She's a great character.
Now, you played on a Pretenders record?
Yeah, the last one. Yeah, it was supposed to be a Chrissy Hynde solo record.
Right.
That's what we were told it was. And the whole time we made that record, that's what we were doing. And then we were informed after it was done and mastered and mixed and sequenced that it was a Pretenders record.
Oh, that old one.
I was like, we're the Pretenders.
Yeah. Like, that old, it's not going to sell if it's just a solo.
We're not the friggin' Pretenders, man.
Yeah,
but, you know, it was really fun working with that.
What was it like working with her?
She was wonderful.
Man, she's great. Such a legend, huh?
Super
totally
serious,
underrated.
Super serious, really an intelligent person. All business when it came to doing her music, man. She knew what she was doing.
Where was that track at? Nashville?
Easy Eye, Dan Arbuck's place in Nashville.
Right.
Yeah.
What's Nashville like right now? It's of course, it's got that new money we're talking about. It's crowded. The rents are high. It's turned into like a San Francisco.
The number one thing in every day is if you have to get in the car, you got to plan your day.
Ah, fucking, you know, traffic,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, it's bad, man. Nashville wasn't ready for... You know, when I arrived there in the late 80s, I was like, this place is a joke. I mean, this, you know, I don't know who's in charge of the highway system here, but they must think it's still 1953, man. I mean, it was so antiquated. The whole local traffic system was like, you got to be kidding me, man. And it was bad then. And now it's like, they don't know what to do because they can't handle all the cars.
That's brutal.
There's no way. It's awful.
Yeah.
It's really bad. I mean, it's like, you know, I come to LA, I'm like, man, I'm glad to be out of Nashville.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah, LA traffic's got nothing on Nashville.
No
traffic.
Shit.
Yeah, people talk about LA traffic. I'm like, get me to LA, man. Get me out of Nashville.
God, that's great, man. It's just
it's
like
crazy, isn't it?
It's you know what I say? Anywhere cool is it just costs a lot and there's traffic. You know,
that's
look
right.
At Austin. Denver, San Francisco, LA, Nashville, Portland,
yeah.
New York. It's just fucking gridlock.
Well, the one thing about Nashville is there's only one reason I live there, and that's because of the music business people,
right.
The players and the songwriters that I work with. There's like so many awesome players and so many awesome songwriters. It's unbelievable. And, you know, the guitar players in Nashville, like Jim Oblon and Jack Pearson, Pat Bergeson, those guys, unreal, man. The best guitar players you're ever going to hear in your life. You know, those guys are just like off the chart, man. It's like, whoa. You know, and I can go watch them anytime I want.
That's
know?
Great,
you
right? Know, the and then you.
I couldn't carry their guitar cases, man. Those cats are the real thing, man.
Are you
hip to Jim Oblon?
No.
Oh, my God.
Did you ever get into, like, Jim Campolongo?
I'm a big fan of his, and so is Jim. We're both big fans of
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, man. He's San Francisco when I was there.
Yeah, I used to go watch
10-gallon hats.
I used to watch that band a lot. I landed in San Francisco many times when those guys were playing.
Yeah.
I'd always go to the gig, and anytime Campolongo's playing, if I'm in the same town, I'm going to be there.
He played the Top Loader. The rare top loader telly.
Oh, yeah.
And now he has his own model and it's a top loader.
Yeah.
You know, which is incredible. If people don't know, telly's the body, the strings go through the body.
Yeah. And
but there was a year.
Tone. And he's also playing one of those Han guitars now.
Oh, yeah.
H-A-H-N
right.
Or something
right,
like that.
Right. Yeah. I remember seeing that in like some magazine.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got one of those, got his own Jim Campolongo model. He's actually taking it on the road and playing it.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are you playing now, mostly guitar-wise?
I've got this, on Marty's tour, we recorded over at Mike Campbell's place here.
Oh, wow.
That Way Out West record, we recorded over there.
Holy shit.
And I'd known him from the Petty days, you know, from when I played with Lucinda on the, you know, opening for those guys.
Of course.
A lot. I think we did like 35 dates opening for those guys. And I got to know them really well. And you know, we talked about guitars every day, you know. And, so over at Mike's place, all those guitars are there. You know?
Unbelievable.
And so he has this old Broadcaster that he bought in the 70s that had somebody had changed the pickup in the bridge and something else about that guitar. The finish had been stripped.
It's the wood-colored one?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And anyway, Fender made 25 copies of Mike's old Broadcaster. Everything copied, every ding in it is reliced exactly a mirror copy of his guitar, you know, the sort of thin profile neck and everything. And I was recording, you know, up there with Marty, and, you know, I played his real one day. And then I was in the bathroom getting a guitar tone. We had my amp was at the bathroom, you know, I'm in there and I'm trying to adjust the amplifier, and I pulled this guitar off the wall that was in this hallway, and it was the copy.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, I plugged it in, and I was like, what is this? You know, and his guitar tech says, oh, that's the copy the Fender made. They made 25 of those things. And Mike got 5 of them, and the other 20 sold out in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was a benefit thing, you know, for a pet rescue or something like that. And anyway, So I plugged it in this amp. I said, man, this guitar is nice, man. I didn't know Fender could still make a good guitar, man. This was awesome, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, and Chinner was like, yeah, it's an exact copy of Mike's guitar, you know. I was like, yeah, no kidding. And so Campbell walked in. He said, do you like that guitar? I said, yeah, man. He said, it's yours.
Wow.
So he gave it to me, you know.
Wow.
So,
oh, man.
So I was like, oh, thanks, man, you know. And I took it, and one day at soundcheck, a couple of weeks later, I plugged it in, and Marty and Chris were both like, there you go, man, that guitar.
Wow.
That sounds really good. And I was like, man, it does sound good, doesn't it? It's a really good guitar.
Wow, so you've been playing that?
Yeah, ever since. It's been a couple of years, maybe a year and a half or so, been playing that. That's been my main guitar.
And how's it breaking in now? Because you play it every gig, and it already came a little relic, thin skin
paint.
Well,
it was already done. It was ready to go, man. I didn't do anything to it. All I did was play it, and I finally changed the strings one day, you know. And I've never even taken it down to have my guy look at it, you know.
Wow.
I've got to take it in there because the nut's a little tight on the G and the B.
Strings are catching up on
it.
Yeah.
I got
to. What about amp? What do you use an amp?
I'm still using my 67 Deluxe Reverb.
Great. Blackface.
In about 1988, maybe.
Same one. Yeah. Same speaker?
A newer Vintage 30, which is what I always used in there before. I tried a couple other things and went back to the Vintage 30. The Vintage 30 now is probably about 20 years old.
How many recaps on it?
Oh, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, have you just been redo it like every 10 years?
I blew one of the output transformers somewhere like in the 90s.
Yeah.
But it's my amp tech is really good. And Todd Sharp, Nashville Amp Service, he's a great guitar player. He's a famous guitar player. And not in Nashville, but in L.A. He used to play with people like Rod Stewart and who else did he play with? Can't remember, but he's really good. He played for Delbert a long time.
Wow.
He's a really good player.
How many guitars you own?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, less than 30 probably.
What, less than 30? Yeah. So you think you'll get a Blackguard one day?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I got to get a Blackguard Esquire.
Better do it pretty quick.
Yeah, I know.
It just keeps going crazy.
I know. They're the best.
They are the best.
Marty,
this is what Carson has one, man. You got to get one.
Marty
of these.
Has a 52.
Ooh.
Esquire.
Ooh, really?
Badass. And of course, he plays Clarence White's B bender.
Oh, he has Clarence White's B bender?
Yeah, that's the only guitar he's known for playing.
Wow.
He plays it every show.
Wow.
Ever since the 80s when he bought it. He bought it when he was with Johnny Cash.
Wow.
He played it with Johnny Cash.
What time are you guys on tonight?
We're not playing tonight. It's tomorrow night.
Oh, Troubadour. Tomorrow night?
I don't know. Troubadour.
I got to go to that.
Probably 8 or 9. I don't know. Something like that.
Shit, man. Can you get me in?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for doing the podcast, dude. I've been a huge fan of you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I think you're one of the greatest.
Where does this thing air? Where?
Every Monday, it's on iTunes, Stitcher, cool. SoundCloud, Spotify.
Cool.
Everywhere. It's everywhere.
All right.
It's, and it's a big listen. Show. You got an Instagram or Twitter or anything?
No.
No?
I should
well,
do that.
I mean, I think a guy like you, if you had an Instagram and you just, you know, videoed some of you playing each day, dude.
Yeah.
I think people need to see you play. As much as I love you, and of course the guitar world and the Nashville world and everything knows you, but I think that you're a fucking treasure.
Oh, thanks, man.
To the guitar, dude. And I'm telling you, man,
appreciate that.
You knocked me out, and you knock me out whenever I get on these YouTube videos. And if you guys want to watch a video that'll really floor you, watch him playing with the trio and doing Ghost Riders in the Sky. It's unbelievable.
That's,
and also,
that's probably pretty old.
But it's great. I love watching it.
I've played that song in years.
It's great watching. And also, Lucinda Williams live at Austin City Limits. It's on DVD.
You know, that was the re-recording.
Re-recording.
It was the only artist I ever played with Austin City Limits that we went in, did a whole day, and then she had a fight with the guitar player and fired him and called her manager and said, you can never let them air that.
Whoa.
And so we had to go back like a month later and reshoot the entire show.
Really?
The guitar player, yeah.
Holy shit. So that one guy, the Dylan guy, gets fired?
No, he was the new guy.
Oh, he was the new guy.
He got the gig to replace Bo Ramsey, who was the guy that got fired. Bo and Lucinda were like brother and sister. They would fight like brother and sister.
Wow.
I know they love each other, but yeah, they would have spats. And this one, like, you know, I'm sure they've made up many years ago, Bob.
Yeah.
Bo's a killer. Bo Ramsey, he's unreal.
So you guys shot it with the audience and everything and then said,
oh, yeah.
Whoa.
And the fight didn't happen until after the show, you know.
Wow.
I don't even know what happened. I wasn't there. You know? I was off down the street having drinks with my friends or something. You know, I missed the whole deal. So
holy shit!
And so I was like, I thought it would blow over, but it didn't. And I thought, well, they'll air that, and they never did. So I don't know, somewhere
there's another version.
Yeah, and Bo Ramsey is just a brilliant player. Like,
wow,
he's like one of the all time genius guys.
Holy shit.
Like one of those guys that has just like super extra heapings of mojo when he plays, you know. He's like,
that's a great story.
Yeah, so if I ever see that Terry Lacona guy, which I'm sure I will, the guy that ran Austin City Limits, I'm like,
cut it loose.
Come on, man.
Yeah, give me a copy.
I want a bootleg of the unreleased.
any was there bad feelings when you were gone? Because I remember
no
I heard stuff where people were like, you were too much of a star, so you were out of there. You know,
no man, Lou is always, she comes to see my band.
Awesome.
In Nashville, she's been to many Marty shows, you know, where she, we've always been friends.
That's great, man.
Oh yeah, I was friends with her before I ever played with her,
right?
Know? So yeah, she's a wonderful person, really. I really like her stuff, man. She's good.
Everybody,
and she recorded with Bill Frisell, my old guitar teacher.
Wow!
After she recorded,
full circle.
After I played in her band, you know. So yeah, yeah.
Get his solo record. It's on iTunes.
That's old too.
Kenny Vaughn, yeah, 2011.
I'm working on a new one now.
Still, you got to do another one, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
That's gonna be great.
Yeah, it'll be better than the last one.
Oh, man. Oh, it's so weird on the cover of that one. You're playing a white falcon.
Yeah.
Yeah, you still got that? I never seen you play a white falcon.
That's just like one of those Japanese reissues.
Gotcha.
Steve Stills model.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Actually, when I play a Gretsch, I have another one that I actually play.
Yeah.
It's a 67 Rally that was rebuilt by a guy named Jeff Sin in Nashville. It had been destroyed, and it got completely rebuilt.
Wow.
So there's no issues with binding or glue.
Yeah.
Like the neck.
Coming apart,
the neck
all that
set
shit.
Is really tight. Everything's like... And it's a brilliant guitar. It's like a 6120 body, double cutaway, and the Rally would have had what are they called, the Hilotron pickups. And
oh yeah,
there weren't any pickups.
Filtertrons.
Yeah, so I got Filtertrons.
Oh, gotcha.
I had an old set, and Jeff put those on there, and it has a newer Bigsby. The Bigsby that was on there was toast. I still have it, but it's just something you put in a museum. It wouldn't work anymore. And it actually broken in half. And it has a Tune-O-Matic bridge, two Filtertrons, and man, it's just such a great guitar.
That's sick, man.
Tight. It's really a good guitar, a good working guitar. And it has a wonderful, the real Gretsch tone, you know?
Yeah.
The real sort of 6120.
Love that shit.
Filtertron sound, you know? I'm more of a Dynasonic guy myself. I would prefer to be playing D'Armond Dynasonics, but... I want to get... Marty has a really good Duane Eddy guitar like that. His is a 56 6120 with the Dynasonics, you know, the Duane Eddy guitar.
I'm a Penguin guy with the D'Armonds.
There you go.
God damn, that's a great
Aren't
guitar.
Aren't those cool?
Underrated.
Man.
Underrated,
those
dude.
Cool. Yeah, I dig those.
I can't thank you enough for doing
the
show.
Thanks, man. Thank you for having me.
And I can't wait to see you tomorrow.
My pleasure.
And man, this has just been a highlight for me, dude. I got to tell you, man. Great to see. I remember when I was making records, I was like, man, if we could get Kenny Vaughn to come in and play on this, man, we'd be fucking, you know what I mean?
I would have been there, man.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Been there. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to Let There Be Talk. And don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel and my podcast on iTunes and leave a review. Candles are lit. See ya.